Only a matter of hours now before Germany intervened. He harbored no enmity against any nation. That the rump state of Czechoslovakia existed at all was attributable only to his loyal attitude. In the autumn he had not wished to draw the final conclusions because he had thought a coexistence possible, but he had left no doubt that if the Benesh tendencies did not disappear completely, he would destroy the state completely. They had not disappeared, and he gave examples. And so, last Sunday, March 12th, the die was cast. He had given the order for the invasion by the German troops and for the incorporation of Czechoslovakia into the German Reich. Hacha and Chwakowski, noted Dr. Schmidt, sat as though turned to stone. Only their eyes showed that they were alive. But Hitler was not quite through. He must humble his guests with threats of Teutonic terror. The German army, Hitler continued, had already marched in today, and at a barracks where resistance was offered it had been ruthlessly broken. Tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock the German army was to enter Czechia from all sides, and the German Air Force would occupy the Czech airfields. There were two possibilities. The first was that the entry of German troops might develop into fighting. In that case, resistance would be broken by brute force. The other possibility was that the entry of the German troops would take place in a peaceful manner, in which case it would be easy for the Führer to accord Czechoslovakia a generous way of life of her own, autonomy, and a certain measure of national freedom. He was doing all this not from hatred, but in order to protect Germany. If last autumn Czechoslovakia had not given in, the Czech people would have been exterminated. No one would have prevented him doing it. If it came to a fight, in 2 days the Czech army would cease to exist. Naturally, some Germans would be killed too, and this would engender a hatred which would compel him in self-preservation not to concede autonomy. The world would not care a jot about this. He sympathized with the Czech people when he read the foreign press. It gave him the impression which might be summed up in the German proverb, "The Moor has done his duty, the Moor can go." That was why he had asked Hacha to come here. This was the last good turn he could render the Czech people. Perhaps Hacha's visit might prevent the worst. The hours were passing. At 6 o'clock the troops would march in. He was almost ashamed to say it, but for every Czech battalion there was a German division. He would like now to advise him, Hacha, to withdraw with Chwałkowski and discuss what was to be done. What was to be done? The broken old president did not have to withdraw to decide that. He told Hitler at once, "The position is quite clear. Resistance would be folly." But how, he asked, since it was now a little after 2 a.m., could he, in the space of 4 hours, arrange to restrain the whole Czech people from offering resistance? The Führer replied that he had better consult with his companions. The German military machine was already in motion and could not be stopped. Hacha should get in touch at once with Prague. It was a grave decision, the German minutes report Hitler is saying, but he saw dawning the possibility of a long period of peace between the two peoples. Should the decision be otherwise, he saw the annihilation of Czechoslovakia. With these words, he dismissed his guests for the time being. It was 2:15 a.m. In an adjoining room, Göring and Ribbentrop stepped up the pressure on the two victims. According to the French ambassador, who in an official dispatch to Paris depicted the scene as he got it from what he believed to be an authentic source, Hacha and Chwałkowski protested against the outrage to their nation. They declared they would not sign the document of surrender. Were they to do so, they would be forever cursed by their people. The German ministers, Göring and Ribbentrop, were pitiless, Monsieur Coulondre wrote in his dispatch. They literally hunted Dr. Hacha and Monsieur Chwałkowski round the table on which the documents were lying, thrusting them continually before them, pushing pens into their hands, incessantly repeating that if they continued in their refusal, half of Prague would lie in ruins from bombing within 2 hours, and that this would be only the beginning. Hundreds of bombers were waiting the order to take off, and they would receive that order at 6 in the morning if the signatures were not forthcoming. On the stand at Nuremberg, Göring admitted that he told Hacha, "I should be sorry if I had to bomb beautiful Prague." He really didn't intend to carry out the threat. That would not have been necessary, he explained, but a point like that I thought might serve as an argument and accelerate the whole matter. At this point, Dr. Schmidt, who seems to have managed to be present whenever and wherever the drama of the Third Reich reached a climax, heard Goering shout for Dr. Morell. "Hacke has fainted!" Goering cried out. For a moment, the Nazi bullies feared that the prostrate Czech president might die on their hands, and, as Schmidt says, that the whole world will say tomorrow that he was murdered at the Chancellery. Dr. Morell's specialty was injections. Much later, he would almost kill Hitler with them, and he now applied the needle to Dr. Hacke and brought him back to consciousness. The president was revived sufficiently to be able to grasp the telephone which the Germans thrust into his hand and talk to his government in Prague over a special line which Ribbentrop had ordered rigged up. He apprised the Czech cabinet of what had happened and advised surrender. Then, somewhat further restored by a second injection from the needle of Dr. Morell, the president of the expiring republic stumbled back into the presence of Adolf Hitler to sign his country's death warrant. It was now 4:05 in the morning of March 15, 1939. The text had been prepared beforehand by Hitler, Schmidt recounts, and during Hacke's fainting spells, the German interpreter had been busy copying the official communiqué, which had also been written up beforehand, and which Hacke and Chwalkowski were also forced to sign. It read as follows. Berlin, March 15, 1939. At their request, the Führer today received the Czechoslovak president, Dr. Hacke, and the Czechoslovak foreign minister, Dr. Chwalkowski, in Berlin in the presence of Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop. At the meeting, the serious situation created by the events of recent weeks in the present Czechoslovak territory was examined with complete frankness. The conviction was unanimously expressed on both sides that the aim of all efforts must be the safeguarding of calm, order, and peace in this part of Central Europe. The Czechoslovak president declared that in order to serve this object and to achieve ultimate pacification, he confidently placed the fate of the Czech people and country in the hands of the Führer of the German Reich. The Führer accepted this declaration and expressed his intention of taking the Czech people under the protection of the German Reich and of guaranteeing them an autonomous development of their ethnic life as suited to their character. Hitler's chicanery had reached, perhaps, its summit. According to one of his woman secretaries, Hitler rushed from the signing into his office, embraced all the women present, and exclaimed, "Children, this is the greatest day of my life. I shall go down in history as the greatest German." It did not occur to him, how could it, that the end of Czechoslovakia might be the beginning of the end of Germany. From this dawn of March 15, 1939, the Ides of March, the road to war, to defeat, to disaster, as we now know, stretched just ahead. It would be a short road and as straight as a line could be, and once on it, and hurtling down it, Hitler, like Alexander and Napoleon before him, could not stop. At 6 a.m. on March 15th, German troops poured into Bohemia and Moravia. They met no resistance, and by evening Hitler was able to make the triumphant entry into Prague which he felt Chamberlain had cheated him of at Munich. Before leaving Berlin, he had issued a grandiose proclamation to the German people, repeating the tiresome lies about the wild excesses and terror of the Czechs, which he had been forced to bring an end to, and proudly proclaiming, "Czechoslovakia has ceased to exist." That night he slept in Hradčin Castle, the ancient seat of the kings of Bohemia, high above the river Moldau, where more recently the despised Masaryk and Beneš had lived and worked for the first democracy Central Europe had ever known. The Führer's revenge was complete, and that it was sweet he showed in the series of proclamations which he issued. He had paid off all the burning resentments against the Czechs which had obsessed him as an Austrian in his vagabond days in Vienna 3 decades before, and which had flamed anew when Beneš dared to oppose him, the all-powerful German dictator, over the past year. The next day, from Hradčin Castle, he proclaimed the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, which, though it professed to provide autonomy and self-government for the Czechs, brought them, by its very language, completely under the German heel. All power was given to the Reich Protector, and to his Secretary of State and his head of the civil administration, who were to be appointed by the Führer. To placate outraged public opinion in Britain and France, Hitler brought the moderate Neurot out of cold storage and named him Protector. On the stand at Nuremberg, Neurot stated that he was taken by complete surprise when Hitler named him Protector, and that he had misgivings about taking the job. However, he says, he took it when Hitler explained that by this appointment he wanted to assure Britain and France that he did not wish to carry on a policy hostile to Czechoslovakia. The two top Sudeten leaders, Konrad Henlein and the gangster Karl Hermann Frank, were given an opportunity to get revenge on the Czechs by being appointed head of the civil administration and Secretary of State, respectively. It was not long before Himmler, as boss of the German police, got a stranglehold on the protectorate. To do his work, he made the notorious Frank chief of police of the protectorate and ranking SS officer. For 1,000 years, Hitler said in his proclamation of the protectorate, the provinces of Bohemia and Moravia formed part of the Lebensraum of the German people. Czechoslovakia showed its inherent inability to survive and is therefore now fallen a victim to actual dissolution. The German Reich cannot tolerate continuous disturbances in these areas. Therefore, the German Reich, in keeping with the law of self-preservation, is now resolved to intervene decisively to rebuild the foundations of a reasonable order in Central Europe. For in the 1,000 years of its history, it has already proved that, thanks to the greatness and the qualities of the German people, it alone is called upon to undertake this task. A long night of German savagery now settled over Prague and the Czech lands. It might be of interest to skip ahead here and note what happened to some of the characters in the drama just recounted. Frank was sentenced to death by a post-war Czech court and publicly hanged near Prague on May 22, 1946. Henlein committed suicide after his arrest by Czech resistance forces in 1945. Chwałkowski, who became the representative of the protectorate in Berlin, was killed in an Allied bombing there in 1944. Hacke was arrested by the Czechs on May 14, 1945, but died before he could be tried. On March 16, Hitler took Slovakia too under his benevolent protection in response to a telegram, actually composed in Berlin, as we have seen, from Premier Tiso. German troops quickly entered Slovakia to do the protecting. On March 18, Hitler was in Vienna to approve the Treaty of Protection, which, as signed on March 23 in Berlin by Ribbentrop and Dr. Tuke, contained a secret protocol giving Germany exclusive rights to exploit the Slovak economy. As for Ruthenia, which had formed the eastern tip of Czechoslovakia, its independence as the Republic of Carpatho-Ukraine, proclaimed on March 14, lasted just 24 hours. Its appeal to Hitler for protection was in vain. Hitler had already awarded this territory to Hungary. In the captured Foreign Office archives, there is an interesting letter in the handwriting of Miklos Horthy, regent of Hungary, addressed to Adolf Hitler on March 13. Your Excellency, heartfelt thanks. I cannot express how happy I am, for this headwater region, Ruthenia, is for Hungary. I dislike using big words, a vital question. We are tackling the matter with enthusiasm. The plans are already laid. On Thursday the 16th, a frontier incident will take place, to be followed Saturday by the big thrust. As things turned out, there was no need for an incident. Hungarian troops simply moved into Ruthenia at 6 a.m. on March 15th, timing their entry with that of the Germans to the west, and on the following day the territory was formally annexed by Hungary. Thus, by the end of the day of March 15th, which had started in Berlin at 1:15 a.m. when Hacke arrived at the Chancellery, Czechoslovakia, as Hitler said, had ceased to exist. Neither Britain nor France made the slightest move to save it, though at Munich they had solemnly guaranteed Czechoslovakia against aggression. Since that meeting, not only Hitler but Mussolini had reached the conclusion that the British had become so weak, and their prime minister, as a consequence, so accommodating, that they need pay little further attention to London. On January 11, 1939, Chamberlain, accompanied by Lord Halifax, had journeyed to Rome to seek improvement in Anglo-Italian relations. This writer happened to be at the station in Rome when the two Englishmen arrived, and noted in his diary the fine smirk on Mussolini's face as he greeted his guests. "When Mussolini passed me," I noted as the party left the station, "he was joking with his son-in-law, Ciano, passing wisecracks." I could not, of course, catch what he was saying, but later Ciano in his diary revealed the gist of it. Arrival of Chamberlain. Jano wrote on January 11th and 12th. How far apart we are from these people. It is another world. We were talking about it after dinner with the Duce. These men are not made of the same stuff, he was saying, as the Francis Drakes and the other magnificent adventurers who created the empire. These, after all, are the tired sons of a long line of rich men, and they will lose their empire. The British do not want to fight. They try to draw back as slowly as possible, but they do not fight. Our conversations with the British have ended. Nothing was accomplished. I have telephoned Ribbentrop that the visit was a big lemonade. A farce. I accompanied the Duce to the station on the departure of Chamberlain, Jano wrote on January 14th. Chamberlain's eyes filled with tears when the train started moving and his countrymen began singing, "For he's a jolly good fellow." What is this little song? The Duce asked. Though during the Sudeten crisis Hitler had been solicitous of Chamberlain's views, there is not a word in the captured German papers to indicate that thereafter he cared a whit what the Prime Minister thought of his destroying the rest of Czechoslovakia despite the British guarantee, and for that matter despite the Munich Agreement. On March 14th, as Hitler waited in Berlin to humble Hacke, and as angry questions were raised in the House of Commons in London about Germany's engineering Slovakia's secession and about its effect on Britain's guarantee to Prague against aggression, Chamberlain replied heatedly, "No such aggression has taken place." But the next day, March 15th, after it had taken place, the Prime Minister used the proclamation of Slovakia's independence as an excuse not to honor his country's word. "The effect of this declaration," he explained, "put an end by internal disruption to the state whose frontier we had proposed to guarantee. His Majesty's government cannot accordingly hold themselves any longer bound by this obligation." Hitler's strategy had thus worked to perfection. He had given Chamberlain his out, and the Prime Minister had taken it. It is interesting that the Prime Minister did not even wish to accuse Hitler of breaking his word. I have so often heard charges of breach of faith bandied about, which did not seem to me to be founded upon sufficient premises, he said, that I do not wish to associate myself today with any charges of that character. He had not one word of reproach for the Führer, not even for his treatment of Hacke and the shabby swindle which obviously, even if the details were still unknown, had been perpetrated at the Reich Chancellery on the early morning of this day, March 15th. No wonder that the British protest that day, if it could be called that. On March 16th, Chamberlain told the Commons that so far no protest had been lodged with the German government, was so tepid, and that the Germans treated it and subsequent Anglo-French complaints with so much arrogance and contempt. His Majesty's government have no desire to interfere unnecessarily in a matter with which other governments may be more directly concerned. They are, however, as the German government will surely appreciate, deeply concerned for the success of all efforts to restore confidence and a relaxation of tension in Europe. They would deplore any action in Central Europe which would cause a setback to the growth of this general confidence. There was not a word in this note, which was delivered on March 15th by Ambassador Henderson to Ribbentrop as an official message from Lord Halifax, about the specific events of the day. The French were at least specific. Robert Coulondre, the new ambassador of France in Berlin, shared neither his British colleague's illusions about Nazism nor Henderson's disdain of the Czechs. On the morning of the 15th, he demanded an interview with Ribbentrop, but the vain and vindictive German foreign minister was already on his way to Prague, intending to share in Hitler's humiliation of a beaten people. State Secretary von Weizsäcker received Coulondre instead at noon. The ambassador lost no time in saying what Chamberlain and Henderson were not yet ready to say, that by its military intervention in Bohemia and Moravia, Germany had violated both the Munich Agreement and the Franco-German Declaration of December 6th. Baron von Weizsäcker, who later was to insist that he had been stoutly anti-Nazi all along, was in an arrogant mood that would have done credit to Ribbentrop. According to his own memorandum of the meeting, "I spoke rather sharply to the ambassador and told him not to mention the Munich Agreement, which he alleged had been violated, and not to give us any lectures. I told him that in view of the agreement reached last night with the Czech government, I could see no reason for any démarche by the French ambassador. and that I was sure he would find fresh instructions when he returned to his embassy, and these would set his mind at rest. 3 days later, on March 18th, when the British and French governments, in deference to outraged public opinion at home, finally got around to making formal protests to the Reich, Weizsäcker fairly outdid his master Ribbentrop in his insolence, again on his own evidence. In a memorandum found in the German Foreign Office files, he tells with evident glee how he refused even to accept the formal French note of protest. "I immediately replaced the note in its envelope and thrust it back at the ambassador, with the remark that I categorically refused to accept from him any protest regarding the Czechoslovak affair. Nor would I take note of the communication, and I would advise Monsieur Coulandre to urge his government to revise the draft." Coulandre, unlike Henderson at this period, was not an envoy who could be browbeaten by the Germans. He retorted that his government's note had been written after due consideration, and that he had no intention of asking for it to be revised. When the State Secretary continued to refuse to accept the document, the ambassador reminded him of common diplomatic practice, and insisted that France had a perfect right to make known its views to the German government. Finally, Weizsäcker, according to his own account, left the note lying on his desk, explaining that he would regard it as transmitted to us through the post. But before he arrived at this impudent gesture, he got the following off his mind. From the legal point of view, there existed a declaration which had come about between the Führer and the President of the Czechoslovak State. The Czech President, at his own request, had come to Berlin and had then immediately declared that he wished to place the fate of his country in the Führer's hands. I could not imagine that the French government were more Catholic than the Pope and intended meddling in things which had been duly settled between Berlin and Prague. Coulandre's version of the interview is given in The French Yellow Book, number 78, pages 102 to 103 in the French edition. He confirms Weizsäcker's account. Later at his trial in Nuremberg, the State Secretary argued that in his memoranda of such meetings, he had purposely exaggerated his Nazi sentiments in order to cover his real anti-Nazi activities. But Coulandre's account of the meeting is only one piece of evidence that Weizsäcker did not exaggerate at all. Weizsäcker behaved quite differently to the accommodating British ambassador who transmitted his government's protest late on the afternoon of March 18th. Great Britain now held that it could not but regard the events of the past few days as a complete repudiation of the Munich Agreement, and that the German military actions were devoid of any basis of legality. Weizsäcker, in recording it, noted that the British note did not go as far in this respect as the French protest, which said that France would not recognize the legality of the German occupation. Henderson had gone to see Weizsäcker on March 17th to inform him of his recall to London for consultations, and, according to the State Secretary, had sounded him out for arguments which he could give Chamberlain for use against the latter's political opposition. Henderson explained that there was no direct British interest in the Czechoslovak territory. His, Henderson's, anxieties were more for the future. Even Hitler's destruction of Czechoslovakia apparently had not awakened the British ambassador to the nature of the government he was accredited to. Nor did he seem aware of what was happening that day to the government which he represented. For, suddenly and unexpectedly, Neville Chamberlain, on March 17th, 2 days after Hitler extinguished Czechoslovakia, had experienced a great awakening. It had not come without some prodding. Greatly to his surprise, most of the British press, even the Times, but not the Daily Mail, and the House of Commons had reacted violently to Hitler's latest aggression. More serious, many of his own backers in Parliament and half of the Cabinet had revolted against any further appeasement of Hitler. Lord Halifax, especially, as the German ambassador informed Berlin, had insisted that the Prime Minister recognize what had happened and abruptly change his course. It dawned on Chamberlain that his own position as head of government and leader of the Conservative Party was in jeopardy. His radical change of mind came abruptly. As late as the evening of March 16th, Sir John Simon, on behalf of the government, had made a speech in the Commons, which was so cynical in regard to the Czechs, and so much in the Munich spirit, that according to press accounts it aroused the House to a pitch of anger rarely seen. The next day, on the eve of his 70th birthday, Chamberlain was scheduled to make a speech in his home city of Birmingham. He had drafted an address on domestic matters, with special emphasis on the social services. On the afternoon train going up to Birmingham, according to an account given this writer by French diplomatic sources, Chamberlain finally made his decision. He jettisoned his prepared speech and quickly jotted down notes for one of quite a different kind. To all of Britain, and indeed to large parts of the world, for the speech was broadcast, Chamberlain apologized for the very restrained and cautious, somewhat cool and objective statement which he had felt obliged to make in the Commons 2 days before. "I hope to correct that statement tonight," he said. The Prime Minister at last saw that Adolf Hitler had deceived him. He recapitulated the Führer's various assurances that the Sudetenland had been his last territorial demand in Europe, and that he wanted no checks. Now Hitler had gone back on them. He has taken the law into his own hands. "Now we are told that this seizure of territory has been necessitated by disturbances in Czechoslovakia. If there were disorders, were they not fomented from without? Is this the end of an old adventure, or is it the beginning of a new? Is this the last attack upon a small state, or is it to be followed by others? Is this, in effect, a step in the direction of an attempt to dominate the world by force? While I am not prepared to engage this country by new and unspecified commitments, operating under conditions which cannot now be foreseen, yet no greater mistake could be made than to suppose that because it believes war to be a senseless and cruel thing, this nation has so lost its fiber that it will not take part to the utmost of its power in resisting such a challenge, if it ever were made." This was an abrupt and fateful turning point for Chamberlain and for Britain, and Hitler was so warned the very next day by the astute German ambassador in London. It would be wrong, Herbert von Dirksen notified the German Foreign Office in a lengthy report on March 18th, to cherish any illusions that a fundamental change has not taken place in Britain's attitude to Germany. It was obvious to anyone who had read Mein Kampf, who glanced at a map and saw the new positions of the German army in Slovakia, who had wind of certain German diplomatic moves since Munich, or who had pondered the dynamics of Hitler's bloodless conquests of Austria and Czechoslovakia in the past 12 months, just which of the small states would be next on the Führer's list. Chamberlain, like almost everyone else, knew perfectly well. On March 31st, 16 days after Hitler entered Prague, the Prime Minister told the House of Commons, "In the event of any action which clearly threatened Polish independence, and which the Polish government accordingly considered it vital to resist with their national forces, His Majesty's government would feel themselves bound at once to lend the Polish government all support in their power. They have given the Polish government an assurance to this effect. I may add that the French government have authorized me to make it plain that they stand in the same position in this matter." The turn of Poland had come.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. Chapter 14. The Turn of Poland. On October 24, 1938, less than a month after Munich, Ribbentrop was host to Józef Lipski, the Polish ambassador in Berlin, at a 3-hour lunch at the Grand Hotel in Berchtesgaden. Poland, like Germany, and indeed in connivance with her, had just seized a strip of Czech territory. The luncheon talk proceeded, as a German Foreign Office memorandum stressed, in a very friendly atmosphere. Nevertheless, the Nazi foreign minister lost little time in getting down to business. The time had come, he said, for a general settlement between Poland and Germany. It was necessary, first of all, he continued, to speak with Poland about Danzig. It should revert to Germany. Also, Ribbentrop said, the Reich wished to build a supermotor highway and a double-track railroad across the Polish corridor to connect Germany with Danzig and East Prussia. Both would have to enjoy extraterritorial rights. Finally, Hitler wished Poland to join the Anti-Comintern Pact against Russia. In return for all these concessions, Germany would be willing to extend the Polish-German treaty by from 10 to 20 years and guarantee Poland's frontiers. Ribbentrop emphasized he was broaching these problems in strict confidence. He suggested that the ambassador make his report to Foreign Minister Beck orally, since otherwise there was great danger of its leaking out, especially to the press. Lipsky promised a report to Warsaw, but warned Ribbentrop that personally he saw no possibility of the return of Danzig to Germany. He further reminded the German foreign minister of two recent occasions, November 5, 1937 and January 14, 1938, when Hitler had personally assured the Poles that he would not support any change in the Danzig Statute. Ribbentrop replied that he did not wish an answer now, but advised the Poles to think it over. The government in Warsaw did not need much time to collect its thoughts. A week later, on October 31st, Foreign Minister Beck dispatched detailed instructions to his ambassador in Berlin on how to answer the Germans. But it was not until November 19th that the latter was able to secure an interview with Ribbentrop. The Nazis obviously wanted the Poles to consider well their response. It was negative. As a gesture of understanding, Poland was willing to replace the League of Nations guarantee of Danzig with a German-Polish agreement about the status of the Free City. Any other solution, Beck wrote in a memorandum which Lipsky read to Ribbentrop, and in particular any attempt to incorporate the Free City into the Reich must inevitably lead to conflict. And he added that Marshal Pilsudski, the late dictator of Poland, had warned the Germans in 1934 during the negotiations for a non-aggression pact that the Danzig question was a sure criterion for estimating Germany's intentions toward Poland. Such a reply was not to Ribbentrop's taste. He regretted the position taken by Beck and advised the Poles that it was worth the trouble to give serious consideration to the German proposals. Hitler's response to Poland's rebuff on Danzig was more drastic. On November 24th, 5 days after the Ribbentrop-Lipsky meeting, he issued another directive to the commanders-in-chief of the armed forces. Top secret. The Führer has ordered, apart from the three contingencies mentioned in the instructions of 10-21-38, the three contingencies were the liquidation of the rest of Czechoslovakia, occupation of Memel, and protection of the Reich's frontiers, preparations are also to be made to enable the Free State of Danzig to be occupied by German troops by surprise. The preparations will be made on the following basis. Condition is a quasi-revolutionary occupation of Danzig, exploiting a politically favorable situation, not a war against Poland. The troops to be employed for this purpose must not simultaneously be earmarked for the occupation of the Memelland, so that both operations can, if necessary, take place simultaneously. The Navy will support the Army's operation by attack from the sea. The plans of the branches of the armed forces are to be submitted by January 10, 1939. Though Beck had just warned that an attempt by Germany to take Danzig would lead inevitably to conflict, Hitler now convinced himself that it could be done without a war. Local Nazis controlled Danzig, and they took their orders, as had the Sudeteners, from Berlin. It would not be difficult to stir up a quasi-revolutionary situation there. Thus, as 1938 approached its end, the year that had seen the bloodless occupation of Austria and the Sudetenland, Hitler was preoccupied with further conquest, the remainder of Czechoslovakia, Memel, and Danzig. It had been easy to humble Schuschnigg and Benesch. Now it was Josef Beck's turn. Yet when the Führer received the Polish foreign minister at Berchtesgaden shortly after New Year's, on January 5, 1939, he was not yet prepared to give him the treatment which he had meted out to Schuschnigg and was shortly to apply to President Hacke. The rest of Czechoslovakia would have to be liquidated first. Hitler, as the secret Polish and German minutes of the meeting make clear, was in one of his more conciliatory moods. He was quite ready, he began, to be at Beck's service. Was there anything special, he asked, on the Polish foreign minister's mind? Beck replied that Danzig was on his mind. It became obvious that it had also been on Hitler's. Danzig is German, the Führer reminded his guest. We'll always remain German and will sooner or later become part of Germany. He could give the assurance, however, that no fait accompli would be engineered in Danzig. He wanted Danzig, and he wanted a German highway and railroad across the corridor. If he and Beck would depart from old patterns and seek solutions along entirely new lines, he was sure they could reach an agreement which would do justice to both countries. Beck was not so sure, though, as he confided to Ribbentrop the next day, he did not want to be too blunt with the Führer. He had replied that the Danzig problem was a very difficult one. He did not see in the Chancellor's suggestion any equivalent for Poland. Hitler thereupon pointed out the great advantage to Poland of having her frontier with Germany, including the corridor, secured by treaty. This apparently did not impress Beck, but in the end he agreed to think the problem over further. After mulling it over that night, the Polish foreign minister had a talk with Ribbentrop the next day in Munich. He requested him to inform the Führer that whereas all his previous talks with the Germans had filled him with optimism, he was today, after his meeting with Hitler, for the first time in a pessimistic mood, particularly in regard to Danzig, as it had been raised by the Chancellor. He saw no possibility whatever of agreement. It had taken Colonel Beck, like so many others who have figured in these pages, some time to awaken and to arrive at such a pessimistic view. Like most Poles, he was violently anti-Russian. Moreover, he disliked the French, for whom he had nursed a grudge since 1923, when, as Polish military attaché in Paris, he had been expelled for allegedly selling documents relating to the French army. Perhaps it had been natural for this man, who had become Polish foreign minister in November 1932, to turn to Germany. For the Nazi dictatorship, he had felt a warm sympathy from the beginning, and over the past 6 years, he had striven to bring his country closer to the Third Reich and to weaken its traditional ties with France. Of all the countries that lay on the borders of Germany, Poland had, in the long run, the most to fear. Of all the countries, it had been the most blind to the German danger. No other provision of the Versailles Treaty had been resented by the Germans as much as that which established the corridor, giving Poland access to the sea, and cutting off East Prussia from the Reich. The detachment of the old Hanseatic port of Danzig from Germany and its creation as a free city under the supervision of the League of Nations, but dominated economically by Poland, had equally outraged German public opinion. Even the weak and peaceful Weimar Republic had never accepted what it regarded as the Polish mutilation of the German Reich. As far back as 1922, General von Seeckt, as we have seen, had defined the German army's attitude. Poland's existence is intolerable and incompatible with the essential conditions of Germany's life. Poland must go, and will go, as a result of her own internal weaknesses and of action by Russia, with our aid. The obliteration of Poland must be one of the fundamental drives of German policy, and is attainable by means of, and with the help of, Russia. Prophetic words. The Germans forgot, or perhaps did not wish to remember, that almost all of the German land awarded Poland at Versailles, including the provinces of Posen and Polish Pomerania, Pomorza, which formed the corridor, had been grabbed by Prussia at the time of the partitions when Prussia, Russia, and Austria had destroyed the Polish nation. For more than a millennium it had been inhabited by Poles, and to a large extent it still was. No nation recreated by Versailles had had such a rough time as Poland. In the first turbulent years of its rebirth, it had waged aggressive war against Russia, Lithuania, Germany, and even Czechoslovakia, in the last instance over the coal-rich Teschen area. Deprived of their political freedom for a century and a half, and thus without modern experience in self-rule, the Poles were unable to establish stable government or to begin to solve their economic and agrarian problems. In 1926, Marshal Pilsudski, the hero of the 1918 revolution, had marched on Warsaw, seized control of the government, and, though an old-time socialist, had gradually replaced a chaotic democratic regime with his own dictatorship. One of his last acts, before his death in 1935, was to sign a treaty of non-aggression with Hitler. This took place on January 26, 1934, and, as has been recounted, was one of the first steps in the undermining of France's system of alliances with Germany's eastern neighbors, and in the weakening of the League of Nations and its concept of collective security. After Pilsudski's death, Poland was largely governed by a small band of colonels, leaders of Pilsudski's old Polish legion, which had fought against Russia during the First World War. At the head of these was Marshal Schmiegli-Ritz, a capable soldier but in no way a statesman. Foreign policy drifted into the hands of Colonel Beck. From 1934 on, it became increasingly pro-German. This was bound to be a policy of suicide, and indeed, when one considers Poland's position in post-Versailles Europe, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that the Poles in the 1930s, as on occasions in the centuries before, were driven by some fateful flaw in their national character toward self-destruction, and that in this period, as sometimes formerly, they were their own worst enemies. As long as Danzig and the Corridor existed as they were, there could be no lasting peace between Poland and Nazi Germany. Nor was Poland strong enough to afford the luxury of being at odds with both her giant neighbors, Russia and Germany. Her relations with the Soviet Union had been uniformly bad since 1920, when Poland had attacked Russia, already weakened by the World War and the Civil War, and a savage conflict had followed. As a result of that war, Poland pushed its eastern boundary 150 miles east of the ethnographic Curzon Line, at the expense of the Soviet Union, a frontier which transferred 4.5 million Ukrainians and 1.5 million white Russians to Polish rule. Thus, Poland's western and eastern borders were unacceptable to Germany and Russia, respectively, a fact which seems to have been lost sight of in the western democracies when Berlin and Moscow began to draw together in the summer of 1939. Seizing an opportunity to gain the friendship of a country so stoutly anti-Russian, and at the same time to detach her from Geneva and Paris, thus undermining the system of Versailles, Hitler had taken the initiative in bringing about the Polish-German Pact of 1934. It was not a popular move in Germany. The German army, which had been pro-Russian and anti-Polish since the days of Zeitz, resented it. But it served Hitler admirably for the time being. Poland's sympathetic friendship helped him to get first things done first: the reoccupation of the Rhineland, the destruction of independent Austria and Czechoslovakia. On all of these steps, which strengthened Germany, weakened the West, and threatened the East, Beck and his fellow colonels in Warsaw looked on benevolently and with utter and inexplicable blindness. If the Polish foreign minister at the very start of the new year had, as he said, been plunged into a pessimistic mood by Hitler's demands, his spirits sank much lower with the coming of spring. Though in his anniversary speech to the Reichstag on January 30, 1939, Hitler spoke in warm terms of the friendship between Germany and Poland, and declared that it was one of the reassuring factors in the political life in Europe, Ribbentrop had talked with more frankness when he paid a state visit to Warsaw 4 days before. He again raised with Beck the question of Hitler's demands concerning Danzig and communications through the corridor, insisting that they were extremely moderate. But neither on these questions, nor on his insistence that Poland join the anti-Comintern pact against the Soviet Union, did the German foreign minister get a satisfactory answer. Colonel Beck was becoming wary of his friends. As a matter of fact, he was beginning to squirm. On February 26th, the German ambassador in Warsaw informed Berlin that Beck had taken the initiative in getting himself invited to visit London at the end of March, and that he might go to Paris afterward. Though it was late in the day, Poland, as Moltke put it in his dispatch, desires to get in touch with the Western democracies, for fear that a conflict might arise with Germany over Danzig. With Beck, too, as with so many others who had tried to appease the ravenous appetite of Adolf Hitler, the scales were falling from the eyes. They fell completely and forever on March 15th, when Hitler occupied Bohemia and Moravia and sent his troops to protect independent Slovakia. Poland woke up that morning to find itself flanked in the south along the Slovak border, as it already was in the north on the frontiers of Pomerania and East Prussia, by the German army. Its military position had overnight become untenable. March 21, 1939, is a day to be remembered in the story of Europe's march toward war. There was intense diplomatic activity that day in Berlin, Warsaw, and London. The President of the French Republic, accompanied by Foreign Minister Bonnet, arrived in the British capital for a state visit. To the French, Chamberlain suggested that their two countries join Poland and the Soviet Union in a formal declaration stating that the four nations would consult immediately about steps to halt further aggression in Europe. 3 days before, Litvinov had proposed, as he had just a year before after the Anschluss, a European conference, this time of France, Britain, Poland, Russia, Romania, and Turkey, which would join together to stop Hitler. But the British Prime Minister had found the idea premature. He was highly distrustful of Moscow and thought a declaration by the four powers, including the Soviet Union, was as far as he could go. "I must confess," Chamberlain wrote in a private letter on March 26th, "to the most profound distrust of Russia. I have no belief whatever in her ability to maintain an effective offensive, even if she wanted to, and I distrust her motives. Moreover, she is both hated and suspected by many of the smaller states, notably by Poland, Romania, and Finland." Filing, The Life of Neville Chamberlain, page 603. His proposal was presented to Beck in Warsaw by the British ambassador on the same day, March 21st, and received a somewhat cool reception as far as including the Russians was concerned. The Polish foreign minister was even more distrustful of the Soviet Union than Chamberlain, and, moreover, shared the prime minister's views about the worthlessness of Russian military aid. He was to hold these views unflinchingly right up to the moment of disaster. But the most fateful event of this day of March 21st for Poland took place in Berlin. Ribbentrop invited the Polish ambassador to call on him at noon. For the first time, as Lipsky noted in a subsequent report, the foreign minister was not only cool toward him, but aggressive. The Führer, he warned, was becoming increasingly amazed at Poland's attitude. Germany wanted a satisfactory reply to her demands for Danzig and a highway and railroad through the corridor. This was a condition for continued friendly Polish-German relations. Poland must realize, Ribbentrop laid it down, that she could not take a middle course between Russia and Germany. Her only salvation was a reasonable relationship with Germany and her Führer. That included a joint anti-Soviet policy. Moreover, the Führer desired Beck to pay an early visit to Berlin. In the meantime, Ribbentrop strongly advised the Polish ambassador to hurry to Warsaw and explain to his foreign minister in person what the situation was. He advised, Lipsky informed Beck, that the talk with Hitler should not be delayed, lest the Chancellor should come to the conclusion that Poland was rejecting all his offers. A slight aggression, by the by. Before leaving the Wilhelmstrasse, Lipsky had asked Ribbentrop whether he could tell him anything about his conversation with the foreign minister of Lithuania. The German replied that they had discussed the Memel question, which called for a solution. As a matter of fact, Ribbentrop had received the Lithuanian foreign minister, Josis Urbšys, who was passing through Berlin after a trip to Rome, on the previous day, and demanded that Lithuania hand back the Memel district to Germany forthwith. Otherwise, the Führer would act with lightning speed. The Lithuanians, he warned, must not deceive themselves by expecting some kind of help from abroad. Actually, some months before, on December 12, 1938, the French ambassador and the British chargé d'affaires had called the attention of the German government to reports that the German population of Memel was planning a revolt, and had asked it to use its influence to see that the Memel Statute, guaranteed by both Britain and France, was respected. The Foreign Office reply had expressed surprise and astonishment at the Anglo-French démarche, and Ribbentrop had ordered that if there were any further such steps, the two embassies should be told that we had really expected that the French and British would finally become tired of meddling in Germany's affairs. For some time, the German government, and particularly the party and SS leaders, had been organizing the Germans of Memel along lines with which we are now familiar from the Austrian and Sudeten affairs. The German armed forces had also been called in to cooperate, and, as we have seen, 3 weeks after Munich, Hitler had ordered his military chiefs to prepare, along with the liquidation of the remainder of Czechoslovakia, the occupation of Memel. Since the Navy had had no opportunity for glory in the march in to landlocked Austria and Sudetenland, Hitler decided that Memel should be taken from the sea. In November, naval plans for the venture were drawn up under the codename Transport Exercise Stettin. Hitler and Admiral Raeder were so keen on this little display of naval might that they actually put to sea from Swinemünde aboard the pocket battleship Deutschland for Memel on March 22nd, exactly a week after the Führer's triumphant entry into Prague, before defenseless Lithuania had time to capitulate to a German ultimatum. On March 21st, Weizsäcker, who much later would proclaim his distaste for the brutality of Nazi methods, notified the Lithuanian government that there was no time to lose, and that its plenipotentiaries must come to Berlin by special plane tomorrow to sign away to Germany the district of Memel. The Lithuanians had obediently arrived late in the afternoon of March 22nd, but despite German pressure administered in person by Ribbentrop, egged on by a seasick Hitler aboard his battleship at sea, they took their time about capitulating. Twice during the night, the captured German documents reveal, the Führer got off urgent radiograms from the Deutschland to Ribbentrop, asking whether the Lithuanians had surrendered as requested. The dictator and his admiral had to know whether they must shoot their way into the port of Memel. Finally, at 1:30 a.m. on March 23rd, Ribbentrop was able to transmit by radio to his master the news that the Lithuanians had signed. At 2:30 in the afternoon of the 23rd, Hitler made another of his triumphant entries into a newly occupied city, and at the Stadttheater in Memel again addressed a delirious, liberated German throng. Another provision of the Versailles Treaty had been torn up. Another bloodless conquest had been made. Although the Führer could not know it, it was to be the last. The heat on Poland. The German annexation of the Memelland came as a very unpleasant surprise to the Polish government, as the German ambassador to Poland, Hans Adolf von Moltke, reported to Berlin from Warsaw on the following day. The main reason for this, he added, is that it is generally feared that now it will be the turn of Danzig and the Corridor. He also informed the German Foreign Office that Polish reservists were being called up. The next day, March 25th, Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr, reported that Poland had mobilized three classes and was concentrating troops around Danzig. General Keitel did not believe this showed any aggressive intentions on the part of the Poles, but the Army General Staff, he noted, took a somewhat more serious view. Hitler returned to Berlin from Memel on March 24th, and on the next day had a long talk with General von Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the army. From the latter's confidential memorandum of the conversation, it appears that the leader had not yet made up his mind exactly how to proceed against Poland. In fact, his turbulent brain seemed to be full of contradictions. Ambassador Lipsky was due back on the next day, March 26th, and the Führer did not want to see him. Lipsky will return from Warsaw on Sunday, March 26th, Brauchitsch noted. He was commissioned to ask whether Poland would be prepared to come to some terms with regard to Danzig. The Führer left during the night of March 25th. He does not wish to be here when Lipsky returns. Ribbentrop shall negotiate it first. The Führer does not wish, though, to solve the Danzig problem by force. He would not like to drive Poland into the arms of Great Britain by doing so. A military occupation of Danzig would have to be taken into consideration only if Lipsky gives a hint that the Polish government could not take the responsibility toward their own people to cede Danzig voluntarily, and the solution would be made easier for them by a fait accompli. This is an interesting insight into Hitler's mind and character at this moment. 3 months before, he had personally assured Beck that there would be no German fait accompli in Danzig. Yet he remembered that the Polish foreign minister had stressed that the Polish people would never stand for turning over Danzig to Germany. If the Germans merely seized it, would not this fait accompli make it easier for the Polish government to accept it? Hitherto, Hitler had been a genius at sizing up the weaknesses of his foreign opponents and taking advantage of them. But here, for almost the first time, his judgment has begun to falter. The colonels who governed Poland were a mediocre and muddling lot, but the last thing they wanted or would accept was a fait accompli in Danzig. The Free City was uppermost in Hitler's mind, but he was also thinking beyond it, just as he had done in regard to Czechoslovakia after Munich had given him the Sudetenland. For the time being, Brauchitsch noted, the Führer does not intend to solve the Polish question. However, it should be worked on. A solution in the near future would have to be based on especially favorable political conditions. In that case, Poland shall be knocked down so completely that it need not be taken into account as a political factor for the next few decades. The Führer has in mind, as such a solution, a borderline advanced from the eastern border of East Prussia to the eastern tip of Upper Silesia. Brauchitsch well knew what that border signified. It was Germany's pre-war eastern frontier, which Versailles had destroyed, and which had prevailed as long as there was no Poland. If Hitler had any doubts as to what the Polish reply would be, they were dissipated when Ambassador Lipsky returned to Berlin on Sunday, March 26th, and presented his country's answer in the form of a written memorandum. Ribbentrop read it at once, rejected it, stormed about Polish mobilization measures, and warned the envoy of possible consequences. He also declared that any violation of Danzig territory by Polish troops would be regarded as aggression against the Reich. Poland's written response, while couched in conciliatory language, was a firm rejection of the German demands. It expressed willingness to discuss further means of facilitating German rail and road traffic across the corridor, but refused to consider making such communications extraterritorial. As for Danzig, Poland was willing to replace the League of Nations status by a Polish-German guarantee, but not to see the Free City become a part of Germany. Nazi Germany by this time was not accustomed to see a smaller nation turning down its demands, and Ribbentrop remarked to Lipsky that it reminded him of certain risky steps taken by another state, an obvious reference to Czechoslovakia, which Poland had helped Hitler to dismember. It must have been equally obvious to Lipsky, when he was summoned again to the Foreign Office the next day by Ribbentrop, that the Third Reich would now resort to the same tactics against Poland which had been used so successfully against Austria and Czechoslovakia. The Nazi foreign minister raged at the alleged persecution of the German minority in Poland, which he said had created a disastrous impression in Germany. In conclusion, the German foreign minister remarked that he could no longer understand the Polish government. The proposals transmitted yesterday by the Polish ambassador could not be regarded as a basis for a settlement. Relations between the two countries were therefore rapidly deteriorating. Warsaw was not so easily intimidated as Vienna and Prague. The next day, March 28th, Beck sent for the German ambassador and told him, in answer to Ribbentrop's declaration that a Polish coup against Danzig would signify a casus belli, that he in turn was forced to state that any attempt by Germany or the Nazi Danzig Senate to alter the status of the Free City would be regarded by Poland as a casus belli. "You want to negotiate at the point of a bayonet," exclaimed the ambassador. "This is your own method," Beck replied. The reawakened Polish foreign minister could afford to stand up to Berlin more firmly than Benesch had been able to do, for he knew that the British government, which a year before had been anxious to help Hitler obtain his demands against Czechoslovakia, was now taking precisely the opposite course in regard to Poland. Beck himself had torpedoed the British proposal for a four-power declaration, declaring that Poland refused to associate itself with Russia in any manner. Instead, on March 22nd, he had suggested to Sir Howard Kennard, the British ambassador in Warsaw, the immediate conclusion of a secret Anglo-Polish agreement for consultation in case of a threatened attack by a third power. But, alarmed by German troop movements adjacent to Danzig and the corridor, and by British intelligence concerning German demands on Poland, which the tricky Beck had denied to the British, Chamberlain and Halifax wanted to go further than mere consultations. On the evening of March 30th, Kennard presented to Beck an Anglo-French proposal for mutual assistance pacts in case of German aggression. In the telegram of instructions to Kennard, it was made clear that Russia was to be left out in the cold. "It is becoming clear," it said, "that our attempts to consolidate the situation will be frustrated if the Soviet Union is openly associated with the initiation of the scheme. Recent telegrams from a number of His Majesty's missions abroad have warned us that the inclusion of Russia would not only jeopardize the success of our constructive effort, but also tend to consolidate the relations of the parties to the Anti-Comintern Pact, as well as excite anxiety among a number of friendly governments." But even this step was overtaken by events. Fresh reports of the possibility of an imminent German attack on Poland prompted the British government on the same evening to ask Beck whether he had any objection to an interim unilateral British guarantee of Poland's independence. Chamberlain had to know by the morrow, as he wished to answer a parliamentary question on the subject. Beck, his sense of relief may be imagined,